If not in the world, Now, what we call the Holocaust, the Germans called physical regeneration through eradication. And they were concerned that the German people, the folk, were under genetic attack and had to be preserved from enemies, mostly from within. And these enemies represented a number of people. Number one, really three groups. There were really only three groups marked for extinction because genetic abnormality could not be dealt with and had to be eliminated. The first group were those who were handicapped and represent degeneracy. And we'll talk about them and what the German physicians did to that. Whoops. The second group were the Jews, who represent only 0.5% of the population, 0.5%, very small, but who represented financial corruption, political subversion, and the destruction of the Jewish people we call the Shoah, the destruction. And the third group were the Roma and Sinti, what in English we call Gypsies, what in German, Yiddish, and other Zigeuner. Not a nice word, but one which says a lot, representing 0.05% and represented the asocials. And it was these three groups that the German annihilated apparatus was directed to. Designed and developed by physicians, particularly psychiatrists, played out to destroy these three groups of people throughout Europe and any place they could get their hands on them. The Roma and Sinti describe what happened to them as the Priamus, the great devourer. And it's sort of interesting when I'm in a joking mood, which is probably all too frequently, I sort of joke about this and say, well, you know, the Germans who wrote everything down decided to destroy the one people who also wrote everything down, the Jews, and we did. Unfortunately, the Roma are not a writing people. There's very little they've written. Some today a bit. Theirs is an oral history, but they remember it quite well. And that term should be remembered. And we put it all together in a term that I understand is not very good, but is very commonly used now in English, the Holocaust, which is, I'm sure you all are as well as aware as I were, that's maybe inappropriate. But show up for Amos. And unfortunately, the mentally handicapped have no term for what was done. The relevance of this, particularly to physicians and I think to most of us, is to understand the central role of medicine, physicians, biologists, and particularly academics in this whole enterprise. Psychiatrists, and particularly academic psychiatry, along with genetics, were sort of prime players, and hopefully that will become clear. The industrialized killing process that was developed is quite interesting, and the killing center is National Socialist Germany's heritage to the world at large. Most importantly, our fiduciary relationship, that which we physicians have with our patients, was completely betrayed. And doctors betrayed their patients, not just because they were Jews, but because they were perceived to be abnormal, mentally deficient, or physically deficient. We need to protect the vulnerable, and we betrayed that. And all the time, we hear to talk about the Nazi analogy, and I'll let you judge that when we're sort of done here, and you can see whether if it's ever appropriate. Now, eponyms, which we're going to be talking about, are a word that's derived from the proper name of a person or a place given to a discovery. It's a shorthand descriptive item that may apply to an anatomical location, a laboratory test, a syndrome, or disease. It's usually an honorific if you give it to a physician. So if you call a physician, give a name of a disease or a process, and name it the physician, that's an honorific for that physician. And medical eponyms that we use very commonly can be in a doctor's names, which we'll talk about this evening, several of them, although there's lots of them. It can be a patient's name. Probably the most common one you'd be aware of would be Lou Gehrig's disease, otherwise known as ALS, named after a patient. Or it could be named after a location and place, Lyme disease, named after the disease in Lyme, Connecticut. But medical eponyms, we're going to pick out three that are still used, and occasionally more so than others. Number one was Reiter's syndrome, which is named after Hans Julius Conrad Reiter. That's his life, that's his place, and it's now known as reactive arthritis. He described the reactive arthritis that he noticed in people who had neurogenital disease in the First World War. Hallervorden Spots syndrome, named after Julius Hallervorden, his colleague Spots, again, lifetime, which is a very complicated neurodegenerative disorder of children, but is well described and occasionally still used as an eponym amongst, as a shorthand amongst physicians. And then probably what is today still the most commonly used eponym, Wegener's granulomatosis, named after Friedrich Wegener, which is a granulomatous, that a certain kind of inflammatory arteritis affecting predominantly the kidneys, lungs, and occasionally the upper airways as well. And I think if we look at these honorifics, if you'll pardon my expression, we'll learn some things about both these people and the help of us. So here's Hans Reiter, who received his MD degree in 1906 from Tübingen, served in the Hungarian army in the First World War, and in 1916 described this reactive arthritis, which was now named for him as Reiter syndrome. He also did some other work. He was quite a well-known infectious disease and infectious disease expert. In 1919 through 1923, he became the chief at the Genetic Biology and Race Hygiene Institute. Race hygiene, we'll talk about, was the German form of eugenics, Rassenhygiene, and it was already established early on, well before Adolf Hitler and the Nazis were elected to power. In Germany, and Reiter was an early proponent of this. And he did so well that he became the chief of experimental therapy at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin. And Rassenhygiene is a complicated issue, but this is the classic textbook of genetics. And there are lots of geneticists today say, well, genetics and eugenics are different. In some ways they are, and in some ways they aren't, because the goal of genetics is to control. Once you start controlling, you sort of have eugenics anyway. But this is the famous textbook of probably the most famous of the time, written by Erwin Bauer here, who was professor of genetics in Berlin. Eugen Fit, whoops.
Hit F5. Top button on the left. No, I did.
Oh, okay. Okay, Eugen Fischer. There we go. Professor of Anthropology at Freiburg, the rector of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, and rector of the University of Berlin for quite a while. And his Fritz Lenz, who was a disciple of Arthur Pletz, who Pletz was the founder of Rassenhygiene, a German physician. And Lenz became the first German chair of racial hygiene in Munich, 1927, well before Hitler takes power. Rassenhygiene was well entrenched throughout the Western world. And it's not necessarily a right-wing, conservative sort of issue. We'll talk more about this. But many, many so-called left-wing, and especially in England and the United States, were eugenicists and big believers in eugenics. But anyway, Fritz Lenz, at the University of Berlin, actually talked about social hygiene and converted it to that. This book was read by Adolf Hitler when he was imprisoned in Landsberg prison in 1924 after his putsch. If you remember that history, he tried to overthrow the government and was put in jail. And he included lots of the material from this book in his book, My Struggle, published in two parts and eventually one part, actually a bestseller rather late in its career in Germany, but it became a bestseller. And this describes quite well what the National Socialists, what Nazis were all about. Hitler said it was the revolution, which is the final step in the overcoming of historicism and the recognition of purely biological values. Nazism was modern, it was revolutionary, it appealed to the academics at the university, which was its great upholders, and its major authoritarian derivation was from biological science. Very much unlike other reactionary movements that were in power throughout Europe, compared to Spain and Portugal and Hungary with their sort of right-wing, conservative, monarchist, aristocratic movements. This was a modern revolutionary movement, as revolutionary in its own view as was perhaps Marxism in the Soviet Union. And to think of anything else is to mistake it. But it was a biological movement, and that was its great appeal to physicians. And academics loved it and flocked to its banners. Adolf Hitler, like many dictators, liked to be portrayed with little girls bringing them flowers. But the phrase here that's particularly important is he was the physician for the German folk, for the German people. The German people were sick. They were genetically threatened. They needed a physician, and that physician was coming. Hitler was known as the Robert Koch, the great German tuberculosis physician. The Robert Koch for politics and the great doctor for the German society. The fundamental concepts, when it boils down to it, Nazism or National Socialism, was that an individual's worth is not intrinsic, is not worth much, but depends on the contribution to society and what you can contribute to the folk. You had to justify your existence to an outside authority, the authority of the state, the authority of the party, which was there to protect the genes. If you view the SS as anything, view them as the genetic police. They had to prove their genetic heredity back to the middle of the 18th century to be a member of the SS, and their job was to enforce and protect the genetics of the German folk. Resources were limited. The economic engine drove this. We can't expend all our money on people who are not worthwhile. Should only be expended on the worthy. Oops. And many of these arguments echo into current days. Julius Hallervoort, a neuropathologist and psychiatrist, and in those days, neuropsychiatry was one. Neurology and psychiatry were very close. At one time, the boards, even in this country, were one. They still are, then they separated. Now they're sort of coming back. I'm not sure where that's going, but it weren't, particularly in Germany. And the thing to sort of keep in mind, way in the back, is that American medical education is modeled after German medical education. Much of our psychiatry today that's practiced in the United States, particularly at our institution, is that modeled on the German model, the biological model of psychiatry. Hallervoort was born in East Prussia, received his degree from Königsberg, was a psychiatrist, became an expert and a great teacher at the Institute for Psychiatry, and in 1922 described this syndrome with Hugo Spots, which was a disease of the extrapyramidal system. And it's not really important exactly what that is, but it led to degeneration and terrible neurological problems in youngsters and infants and young children. But by 1928, he established a central sort of autopsy service, Prosektorat, in Brandenburg, which was right outside of Berlin. So Ryder now, by 1928, is director of the public health service in Mecklenburg in northern Germany. He joins the Nazi Party, Ryder does, in 1931, before they're in power. He has a Nazi Party number of 880,000, which is fairly low. There were a total of about eventually 4 million members of the Nazi Party. You keep that number in mind as you go through these. His SS number, which was also rather low, number R23666. In 1932, he was elected as a Nazi deputy, and he signed an oath of an allegiance to Adolf Hitler before it was required. So Ryder was a undetermined Nazi, or determined Nazi. By 1933, he becomes director of the KWI of Experimental Therapy in Berlin. And throughout the war, from 1933 through 1945, He's the president of the Reichsgesundheitsamt, the public health department, if you will, of Nazi Germany. In the Department of the Interior, he was a corresponding member of the Royal Society of London and was promoted to SA-Standartführer, to a colonel in the SA, the Brown Shirts, in 1941. Frederick Wegener, okay, of Wegener syndrome, born in 1907, received his MD degree from Kiel in 32. In 1932, again fairly early, joined the SA, Sturm Abteilung, again the Brown Shirts, joined the Nazi Party in 33, number 2 million, pretty much late, but still the 50% mark. And in 1933, became assistant to pathology at Kiel under the director, Martin Stengler, who was a well-known Nazi racial hygienist and a very strong national socialist. Why people do what they do is sort of unknown. Why did Wegener really become a Nazi? We really don't know. Motivation is always hard. It's important to recognize that about 50% of German doctors joined the Nazi Party, the highest percentage of any profession. Why? Some of it was economic. Some of it was because they were appealed to because biology was so important. If biology is important, then prevention is important, and the health of the folks is important, we need you now. And German doctors responded. In addition, it makes you sort of wonder, because this is Wegener's brother, who was rose to the rank of general in the SS, a very important player in Gauleiter as well, and was imprisoned by us, the United States, for 6 years following the war. Whether he thought his brother was going to grease the way, whether his brother helped, whether they shared common beliefs, I don't know. So 1932 comes, and Germany is a small, relatively small, most of Eastern Germany up here, as you know, which is where the East Prussia was taken away after the First World War. But 1932 election finds the Nazi Party in ascendancy. Nazi Party in that election became a plurality in the Reichstag. People tend to think that the Nazis somehow, Hitler took over. He sort of did, but they were elected first. They were elected first. They were a plurality in the Reichstag. Whoops. I'm not sure how that's my little... Okay, here we go. Sorry. The communists... very small, relatively small, and a socialist, and these two wasted time fighting one another instead of standing up tall to that. And you know the history when Hitler was finally appointed as chancellor in 1933, Hindenburg is president, and eventually Hindenburg dies and Hitler assumes both. At that point in time, Reiter is in Berlin as president of the Public Health Society. Hallervorden is establishing his central protectorate at Brandenburg, and Wegener is up in Kiel working in pathology. The National Socialists would lose little time following Hitler's designation as chancellor in starting their racial policies and their genetic policies. In June of 1933, an expert committee, like all great things, begins with an expert committee, on questions of population and racial policy, 50% were physicians, and they estimated that 20% of the German population was genetically defective. Okay? And they were really upset that they were behind America. Okay? America started, the United States of America, started enforced sterilization in 1907, in Indiana, reached its peak. In fact, Virginia didn't repeal its forced sterilization laws until 1970 or 80 or something, right? Sort of interesting. Not only that, Hitler frequently referred to the fact that America had solved its Jewish problem with the 1924 immigration law, which was aimed at restricting Jewish and Italian immigration into the United States. And Germany now is sitting here in 1930, or 30 years behind America. They have to catch up. And they were really going to do it quite in style. And in 1933, Germany passed the law for the prevention of genetically diseased offspring. 1,700 genetic courts were established, which consisted of a district judge and two physicians. Physicians were required to report patients who had what was thought to be genetic diseases, be that epilepsy or other things, much as we are required or were required to report STDs or venereal diseases in those days, and physicians, of course, performed those procedures. This was thought to be necessary, number one, to save the folk from the genetic problems that were all over, and number two, it would have a great economic advantage. It would only cost about 14 million marks and save about 1 billion marks. Ernst Rudin, a Swiss-born psychiatrist who approved and wrote the description of this law. Ernst Rudin was a founder of the Rassen Hygiene Society along with Alfred Pletz. He was the head of genealogical research at the KWI from 1917 through 1945. And interestingly, I think, in 1932 he was unanimously elected president of the International Federation of Eugenics at their third Congress in New York City at the Museum of Natural History, sponsored by Avril Harriman's mother and others who paved the way over. So, I'm not sure exactly what that means, but that's sort of interesting, if nothing else. The fact that this went on in the Museum of Natural History in New York itself is sort of quite interesting, and you can get their sort of pamphlets, and they're there. At any rate, Rudin is a great genetic psychiatrist, and he prepared the official commentary on the law for the prevention of genetically diseased offspring, which was the sterilization law, which led to it was non-racial, but was to ensure that inferior, and Ryder says, to ensure that inferior genetic material will be excluded from further transmission. His office, public health, was in charge of being sure that all these sterilizations were carried out. And by 1937, 250,000 Germans had been sterilized, ultimately 400,000. But what's interesting and implicit in this concept is that if inferior genetic material will have to be excluded, and if you miss it by sterilization, why allow it to survive at all? Why allow it to survive at all? And thus there's this logical progression, where prevention is thought to be more important than treatment, because you can't treat genetic disease very well. You start out with compulsory sterilization to inhibit the birth of those potentially unfit infants, euthanize those children who escape sterilization but somehow are born anyway, so you eliminate anything not prevented, and then you put in place adult euthanasia to cleanse the present and eradicate the past of the folk, and leave the folk a healthier, better, and wealthier place. In order to carry this same process out for Jews and Gypsies, one had to begin to isolate Jews and Gypsies. The handicapped are already isolated. Many of them are institutionalized. They're easily identified. But what has to start to happen now to Jews and Gypsies is exclude them from society, particularly Jews. And what's interesting is that the Tzigoina, Gypsies, were always excluded from many societies. It's quite. And this is a picture from 1928 with German policemen checking on a Gypsy caravan. And in 1929, well, 4 years before the Nazis got, the Central Office for the Fight Against Gypsies in Germany was established by the liberal Weimar Republic. 1933, when after Hitler comes, Jews are removed immediately, very quickly, from the professions and civil service. 1934, the law for revocation of German citizenship was to revoke any citizenship from Roma, Gypsies again, Eastern Jews, and other undesirable foreigners. And in 1935, the two Nuremberg laws were passed, which forbid Germans from marrying Jews, Negroes, and Gypsies, and then the Reich Citizenship Law, which would determine who could be a citizen of the Reich. What was really important was for everybody to understand in Germany that all this was going to be scientific. So they wouldn't be uncomfortable. No mistakes would be made. This is going to be scientific. We're going to understand what Jews are, what gypsies are, and you don't have to worry. And the phrase in German was Rechtssicherheit, secureness and right, that mistakes won't be made. Science will be carried out. And to carry out the head of the fight against gypsies, Dr. Robert Ritter was picked. Dr. Robert Ritter was a physician and a psychiatrist, a child psychiatrist. And he was recommended by this and by a group including Hans Reiter, who we know, and Herbert Linden, who we'll talk about a little bit from the Department of Interior. In 1936, he headed up the Racial Hygiene and Criminal Biology and Research Unit because gypsies were thought to be the asocial people par excellence. They were ruthless. They were criminals by genetics. And if we could understand the gypsies, that will get to the root of criminality. And understand it and eradicate it. And in 1936, he became the head of the Eugenic and Population Biological Research Station of the Reich Health Office. The exclusion and racial identification was really important. And the problem is there was no such thing. And so you needed to exclude Jews, and this is an example, this only for Jews on this bench here in Germany. They started to exclude Jews and push them out. But there were no defining biological characteristics of Jews. There was no genetic test. So the National Socialists resorted to those whose grandparents had registered in a synagogue or other Jewish organization. So I guess we didn't know we were sitting in a somehow genetic defined building here in some way. The Roma, interestingly enough, were Christian. Gypsies were Christian. But they also, they tried to identify them with physical anthropology. This is checking an eye chart. This was Ritter's young assistant who went on that great career with PhD, et cetera, et cetera. Checking this person to see what color eyes, how they fit, measuring faces. But again, there was no way to really physiologically identify them, so they fell upon birth records and other forms of past registration. What's sort of interesting and sort of crazy about this business is that for the Jews, the more the Jews intermarried with Germans, the more diluted the bad Jewish genes were. So as you know, if only one grandparent was Jewish, or if you had no grandparent, maybe way back in the past, you were sort of okay. So that could be diluted for Jews. For gypsies, it was thought to work exactly the opposite. The more hybridized gypsies became, the worse and more asocial they became. So I'm not quite sure of the scientific rationale for that, but that's how it was sort of approached. Now, Wegner becomes a full assistant in 34 in Kiel, and he does an autopsy on a man in 1934 who died of renal failure, and in 38 he gets somebody, a case of a 36-year-old woman from Breslau. And while this is all going on, he's doing his scientific work. He's promoted to the rank of lieutenant colonel in the Sturmabteilung in the SA. And he finally writes this famous paper, which is quite quoted, which gives it the name Wegener's granulomatosis to his form of Wegener's, or his form of granulomatous arteritis. 1939, as most of you know, September, Germany invades Poland. And the war begins. And about the same time, there was a birth in Leipzig, Germany, which had a major promoting impact on the whole plan for euthanasia throughout Europe. It was the Nauer case, in which a child was born markedly handicapped. They asked Hitler himself, could they euthanize this child? Werner Kittel, who was a psychiatrist at Leipzig, was examining the child. Hitler dispensed his personal physician, Karl Brandt, to check this child out. And eventually, while consulting with Brandt, Kittel's assistant administered a lethal injection to the infant, which this became the index case beginning child euthanasia throughout Germany. 1939 became obligatory to report all handicapped newborns. This progressed, as we'll talk, through the adult psychiatric program or the Tiergartenstrasse 4 program. development and use of gas chambers by psychiatrists, gassed their patients, and became the model for the killing sentence used throughout the East, the euthanasia campaigns in Poland and Germany, and eventually the endlessing the final solution of the Jewish problem throughout all of Europe. There was never a euthanasia law in Germany. Hitler did backdate a letter in which he says, Reichsleiter Bohler and Dr. Medicine Brandt are charged with the responsibility to extend the power of specific doctors in such a way that after the most careful assessment of their condition, those suffering from illnesses deemed to be incurable may be granted a mercy death. And this letter was thought to be necessary in order to convince physicians that it was really okay to join up and participate in this. And the administrative organ, here's a picture of Bula, and this is Dr. Brandt, who was hung at Nuremberg. Trying to weed your way through the Nazi state is unbelievable, because there were so many parallel organizations. We all have this sort of vision of a totalitarian state where Hitler authority is giving orders, everybody's following it. Not at all true. He's either set up on purpose or for whatever. There were all these competing fiefdoms which would fight and argue and compete. The party had duplicate structures to the state. The state had duplicate structures to the Führer's own chancellery. And it was all, whether it was all done on purpose or not is very unclear, but to weed through it is very, very difficult. But the administrative organization of the euthanasia program sort of begins in part in the Führer's chancellery, his secretariat, if you will, headed up by Victor Brock and Dr. Heidel Hellermann in office number 2. And in the Reich Ministry of the Interior, by Herbert Linden, Department number 4. And their job was sort of to get the doctors together, manage the program, be sure you could get everything sort of moving. They didn't really care much how the children were going to be killed as long as everything was taken care of. And what they really needed was the security services, and the main reason to have the security services with Albert Wiedemann was so they could obtain enough drugs. The initial way of killing these children was with luminol, barbiturates. And they needed tons of it, or lots of it. And it was like, how do you get it? Well, we'll get the security services to get us that. And it was this sort of integrated attempt at putting all these sort of programs together in which they could then interact with one another, let the physicians find the best methods, carry it out, and carry out this program as best as you can. And this went on, actually, even into the American occupation. American forces were shocked when they found out that even after Germany had surrendered, German hospitals were still killing their children who were handicapped. In order for adults, there's a Reich Committee for the Scientific Registration of Serious Hereditarily and Generally Based Illnesses. This was basically a front organization. This was a post office box to sort of carry out how we were going to assess and take care of these people. There were 3 pediatricians, Hans Heinze at Brandenburg, Werner Kittel, pediatrics, a psychiatrist in Leipzig, and Wenzel, I guess, that include the private practitioners in Berlin. Their forms were reviewed, marked with a plus or a minus. Each was sent to special pediatric wards for expert care. What the quote was, under expert medical supervision, the psychiatric children's ward at Gordon near Brandenburg on Havel will provide all available therapeutic interventions made possible by recent discoveries. That basically meant they were going to be taken there, given luminol, barbiturate, starved, allowed to get pneumonia, and to die. Eventually, they would progress. There are about 5,000 children murdered like this in these places. 22 hospitals throughout the Reich. Remember, the Reich includes Vienna at this time. And this is the adult program in Tiergartenstrasse 4. This is a picture of Tiergartenstrasse 4 in Berlin. That was a house that was Aryanized from Jews. It no longer exists. There's a plaque on the floor, on the sidewalk in Berlin. But T4, again, was strictly a front operation and organization, which required, first and foremost, registration of everyone in mental and hospital nursing homes, particularly Jewish patients, details of each institution, the number of staff, where they're located, how close to what transportation, every form is to be completed by a physician for each patient, and then in that way, they were selected for euthanasia. chairs of psychiatry from the universities of Würzburg, Heidelberg, Jena, Berlin, were major issues. Max DePrentice was a, we had a chance to talk a little more about him. Heinz Heide as well, well-known psychiatrist, the standard sort of incurable diseases. They'd been in an asylum for 5 years, confined as criminally insane, patients without German citizenship, that meant Jews, Gypsies, and others from the East. Patients not of Germanic or related blood, war veterans were excluded for a bit, or those capable of useful work, as well as those patients suffering from a stroke. I'm not quite sure what the saving grace of a stroke was, but it's sort of an interesting sort of sideline. And with this, in order to carry this out, Wiedemann and Brock thought what they would do was build special dormitories and then allow gas to come into the dormitories and gas the patients. But this proved really not feasible. So instead, what they decided to do, rather than bringing the gas to the patient, they decided to bring the patients to the gas. And Brandt told this American interrogator after the war, quote, "This is just one case where in medical history, medical jumps are being made. In the anatomy of the killing center, okay, which is basically the hardware of killing, gas chambers, and the software, the mechanism by which patients are brought, told they're going to shower, hang up their clothes, progress through, was developed by psychiatrists predominantly to kill their patients. It was, these are the major ones, you can read where they were, Hadamar being very famous, Hardheim, Dornstein. The anatomy was variable from place to place, but pretty much the same, a garage where the patients would be delivered. They come through a sluice, going into a waiting and undressing room, in this case in Berenberg. They went from there, waiting in the registration room, downstairs, put into a gas chamber, gassed, taken to a dissecting room if they were thought interesting enough for dissection, and then put into a crematorium. So the hardware and software, the method of transporting, of the whole method of killing, was this killing center, which Nazi Germany has bequeathed to the world. Picture of the gas chamber at Berenberg, and this is by Victor Brock testifying. Chamber was constructed to resemble showers, 3 by 5 meters large and 3 meters high, paneled with ceramic tiles. Benches for the patients lined the walls about 10 centimeters above the floor, pipe with a circumference of about 1 inch ran along the wall. In this pipe, there were small holes which the gas could enter the chamber. The door to the chamber was constructed like a metal air raid shelter with a rectangular window for viewing. January 1940, first demonstration. Victor Brock witnessing. This action must be carried out by doctors. Syringes are a matter for doctors. Victor Brock was the son of a physician. He was actually a test driver for BMW, which occasionally gives me the willies when I drive my car. He was Himmler's driver. And what he got was a huge outpouring of help from psychiatry. After the war, he said, "We welcomed it because it was based on the ethical principle of sympathy and had considerations in its favor. I admit there were imperfections in its executions, but that doesn't change the decency of the original idea, as Buhler, Brandt, and I myself understood it." One physician, by way of further, it is just a listing, I believe, of the euthanasia physicians and others. It wasn't just a few. It was a big process. Most of them psychiatrists, although not all of them. And this is one physician who was not a psychiatrist, Dr. Erl, an Austrian, received his degree at Innsbruck. And basically he went to Brandenburg and then Berenberg and worked for T4 and became buddies with Hallervorden, and Hallervorden would order up certain children to be taken, their brains taken out, and sent to Hallervorden to study. He performed the same services both at Brandenburg and at Berenberg for him. Importantly, and I think of interest to us, it always shocks me, is that Infred Abel was the first commandant of Treblinka, a doctor, a physician, was the commandant of Treblinka Vernichtungslager, annihilation camp, where during Action Reinhardt, you may be aware, more than 1 million Jews were gassed, And an unknown number of Roma were gassed in 9 months during that, including the camps at Belchik, et cetera, and Sobibor, and other. But it was a physician. Actually, Infidergo was removed as commandant at Treblinka because he was very efficient at killing, but not so good at cleaning up, and the Germans really didn't like that so much. So he was removed, and at any rate, there's Brandenburg, and that's where Brandenburg was in relation to Berlin. Hal Avoyden was the prosector, as we've said. He's getting these brains, personally performed autopsies at Brandenburg Killing Center. He selected 33 patients for his study on inherited feeble-mindedness before personally removing their brains at the Killing Center. He collected almost 700 brains for study. These brains were in use until well after the war, until a friend of mine, Victor Seidelman, actually got them at Picket Tübingen to bury most of those specimens that were still being used. They came from the euthanasia program in the Reich and from Jewish hospitals in Warsaw and Lublin. Interestingly, post-war, Hal Avoyden published 12 scientific articles. Post-war. Most frequently cited was the effect of carbon monoxide on fetal brain, the result of a mentally ill mother being gassed at 5 months gestation. Here's Julius Hal Avoyden, and his explanation was, I heard that they were going to do that, so I went up to them and told them, look here now, boys, if you're going to kill all those people, then let's take their brains out so the material can be utilized. There was wonderful material amongst those brains. Beautiful mental defectives, malformations, early infantile diseases. I accepted those brains, of course. Where they came from and how they came to me was really none of my business. Children were killed because they did not fit into the projected future German society. But what Hal Avoyden did was particularly egregious. Not only did he use this material, which others did as bad enough, but he actually selected it. Anyway, the war starts September 1st, 1939. The Germans occupy West Poland September 8th, 1939. And Germany begins to expand eastward, going this way. And our friend Wegener now gets stationed. He's now in the Wehrmacht, but he also is working for the Gesundheitsamt, the public health service. And he's sent to Łódź, Poland, which originally had approximately 233,000 Jews in it, the second largest Jewish population of any city in Europe. And Wegener became the director of the Pathological Institute at Łódź. The city of Łódź itself was renamed by order of Führer, Litzmannstadt, the name of Litzmann, who was a German general who died during the First World War trying to take this from the Russians. And in 1939, December 11th, in the Watergau, which was part of Łódź, which was part of now Germany, their Gau leader ordered Jews to be wearing a yellow Star of David on the right breast and back, and the first ghetto was formed here in Łódź. And Jews were moved in the winter of 1940, and it was the first sealed ghetto that was fenced, eventually sealed, and the ghetto on April 30th was ordered sealed. And interestingly, this is where the ghetto is, and Wegener's office, Dr. Wegener, in the Reichsgesundheitsamt, in the Pathology Institute, was at its closest here. The ghetto is right here, as you'll see. Here's his office right here, 3 blocks away from the northwest corner of the ghetto. The Litzmannstadt ghetto was quite famous. The Germans didn't want to lose this big street, you see. I mean, you have to be efficient. So why do we want to lose this big street with all the traffic? So we built a ghetto here, here, and then we put a bridge over it, which is seen in several movies. I believe The Pianist, the one of them, really sort of featured that. It's inconceivable to me that Friedrich Wegener didn't know what was going on in the Litzmannstadt ghetto, especially with the forced labor, which Jews had to do in order to survive. As you know, Litzmannstadt, the Jews believe, and I will never, ever criticize any of that, the way to survive is to live. You have to cooperate and live. At least some of us can get a stand. We can live to the next selection. We'll give up our children, etc. It's a horrible story, which many of you know. In addition to Jews, Himmler decided that there should be a Zigeunerlager, a gypsy camp, also in Litzmannstadt. And it was established for gypsies from Germany and Austria. And the Jews who went to visit it were shocked at how bad the conditions were in the Tzigoyne Lager compared to their conditions, which were absolutely horrendous. Wegener's autopsy rate increased markedly in Lichtenstadt. And all this was going on at the same time. The Sonderkommandos, special commander, were working, and Lahm, who came from Tegartenstrasse 4, was actively in Poland, going from mental home to mental home, gassing by mobile gas vans at various mental homes, including local Poles, and in the Koshin home, many Jews who were transported from Germany to this particular mental home and were gassed by Lahm. And Lahm was going along gassing and doing such good work that Himmler said, I tell you what, you need to establish a special place that we can do this in the water gown. You need to establish a Vernichtungslager that stops us moving from mental home to mental home. And so Lahm picked Helmhof to establish the first annihilation camp, where Jews were taken from the Lodz ghetto by train, long line to the train station, right past Wegener's office, taken by train, put into open railway cars, sent by open railway cars to Chełmno, taken out of the railway cars, made to walk the rest of the way, where they were met in a sort of what they called a castle, put into the back of vans. In the vans, carbon monoxide came from the exhaust system right around there, and the Jews were driven around for about 15 minutes, and then all were dead, were dumped in the woods, burned by Jews who would soon go through the same sort of process. Polish scholars estimate conservatively that in those four camps, including Chełmno, 2 million Jews, 50,000 gypsies, one-third of whom were children, were killed. These are pots that were left by the gypsies who were deported to Chełmno. And in 1942, German and Polish gypsies who were imprisoned in the Warsaw ghetto were then deported to Treblinka, where they were also gassed. Gypsies from Germany were deported to Białystok, Krakow. They basically followed wherever a Jewish ghetto was placed. Gypsies were sent as well, and they both met the same fate. The survivors of the Lodz ghetto were killed in Auschwitz, in spite of all their work, and ghetto was liquidated July 15, 1944. Russian Soviets liberated Lodz in January 45, found 877 Jews left hidden in the ruins of Lodz from 233,000. The Paramos, Great Devouring, this is a famous picture, but it represents a Tsigoyna, there's the Z, gypsy, from Auschwitz. 1944, Hitler ordered all gypsy camps closed, resulting in the liquidation of all Romanis. 1944, a famous place in Auschwitz, Sigoyanenacht, they liquidated, with literally gypsy night, liquidated the gypsy camp. 4,000 Roma were gassed and burnt in a single action at Auschwitz-Birkenau. In 1945, when the Soviets liberated Auschwitz, they found one Romani survivor. One Romani survivor. 1947, at Nuremberg Military Tribunal, SS General Otto Ollendorf states, there was no difference between gypsies and Jews as far as the killing campaign. So, today we remember the handicapped, 200,000 to 250, the Jews killed in the Shoah, 5-6 million, 6.5 million. The destruction, the Roma, Sinti, the Priamos, 250 to 500,000. But what about the ending of the war? What happened to our doctors? Well, Wegener was in Lodz, and he got the theory in 1944, and by 1945, in January, they knew the Soviets were coming. He and 80,000 Germans left Lodz in panic. Wagner was wanted by the Polish Institute for the Prosecution of German War Crimes, was forwarded to the United Nations War Crimes Commission, and interestingly enough, his folder is empty, and there's not anything in that particular folder. Reiter was arrested by the Soviets, turned over to the Americans. We interrogated and imprisoned him for 2 years, tried to find out stuff, didn't get very much. Hal Borden became and stayed the director of brain research, the KWI. He was briefly interrogated by Leo Alexander, a man who was a physician who was kind of responsible for the medical trials at the medical end of the medical trials at Nuremberg. Whoops. And these are some of the experiments, of course, that was carried out, which they were tried at in Nuremberg, many experiments. But finally, Reiter was really indicted and found to be really committed and involved in infecting prisoners with spotted fever. And there's no doubt that he really was guilty of that, but he never spent any time in jail other than 2 years in which he was predominantly interrogated. And so the war ends, and we enter a period that I call the Fourth Reich, the pathophysiology of silence, which remained that way until about 1968. There was nothing silent. Reiter was prisoned for 2 years, and then he went back to practicing medicine in Germany. He resumed his academic life, published 11 papers from 1947, delivered the keynote address at the International Congress of Rheumatology in 1961. Died in 1969 at the ripe old age in bed of 88. Hal Borden resumed his academic life at Max Planck Institute, became chairman of the Association of German Neuropathologists, received an honorary doctorate at the University of Gießen, died in 1966, age 84. Pathology was collection and use all the time until 1990 when Seidelman and others made him bury that there too. Wagner became a pathologist at Lübeck University, though he never got an academic position. But when he retired, he had a torch-like parade. When he retired, he was loved by his students. And then I found out that Wagner, this is Dr. Wagner, this is Dr. Richard Deremy, once a friend of mine, got an honorary award from my organization, the American College of Chest Physicians. He was given the Master Clinician Award. And when I try to find out about it and call about it, they said, we don't have any record of it, and da-da-da-da-da, what are you talking about, Frank? These were my friends, and they were not unfriendly to me, but I said, that wasn't the remedy yet. And then a friend of mine, who I'll show you his name, Alex, sent me this picture from Europe. There is Wagner in the American College of Chest Physician gown, and there's Dick Deremy with him. Oh, we better look and see. And they did, sure enough, it was a one-time award. And it was a little bit of a fuss in October 2007. And I thought it's always there. But I thought, this is a man who never witnessed. He never said once, I saw what happened. Not that he was necessarily guilty. I don't expect people to be heroes. Who would stand up for a knock on a door of someone saying they're going to kill me, let me in, hide me? I'm not sure I would. I don't know. I don't answer that. But afterwards, when it was safe, why couldn't say, I was at lunch, I saw. Never. Not a word. I didn't think he deserved the award, neither did the American College. And on October 7th, they unanimously rescinded his Master Clinician Award. We're trying to replace Wagner's granulomatosis, both there in rheumatology, the ANCA plus necrotizing granulomatosis, and do the same thing. I must say, it's not over. Dick Deremy, and I showed you, was organizing a number of one Polish physician in particular to try to rejuvenate Wagner and calling myself and my colleague, Dr. Madison, and all sorts of things about this. Actually, Dr. Deremy wrote to the Lancet, he wrote something. He said, they are now demanding their pound of flesh. Their pound of flesh. When I hear that, when I hear Shylock quoted about myself and Madison at Mayo Clinic, was not Jewish, but nevertheless, it sort of struck me as interesting. Interesting. So we have three physicians who are academics and scholars, well-liked, disturbed moral compass for all of them, I think at the least. Reiter was a confirmed and unrepentant national socialist. Hal Borden was an opportunist, consumed by the research imperative, to say the least. Wagner, at the least, observer who refused forever to be a witness. Now, one more physician, because this just came up, and I'm going to finish with this one thing. This is Max Clara at the University of Leipzig, a Nazi, someone who threw all the Jews off the faculty at Leipzig, but who identified in this picture in bronchoepithelial cells a cell called the Clara cell. The Clara cell, because it's named after him. And the question is, should he have the honor? Should he have the honor of having an eponym named after him? And we thought not. Most of the stuff he did was on bodies that were killed by Germans, Nazis, that were sent to his pathology laboratory. And so we wrote this editorial that's going to be, I think, next week or so in the European Respiratory Journal. Painted Eponyms in Medicine, the Clara cell joins the list. By Madison and Alex Vogt and myself to sort of deal with this problem. Eponyms are a dangerous business. I don't like to point guilt at the end, but I think if we at least understand what those names mean and what they were at least part of, we can understand a little bit about what went on in Europe between 1933 and 1945. And I talked too long and I apologize. So, thank you very much for your attention.
Do you want to take that?
Questions? Yes, sir. Oh, Rail. Yes. I apologize for calling you sir, Dr. Sunday.
Sorry. Okay. How do you actually sort of put together these evidence? In other words, how do you do the research to come across Clara?
Well, it's really what's really upsetting is if you want to be upset, you go on the net, go to Leipzig University, and you can see they have a list of, go to their medical school, okay, and go look and see, just I'm picking on Leipzig because I was looking up Clara, actually. And what sort of shocked me when you go on their thing and look at their professors of medicine, there's Werner Cattell listed on their list of professors of medicine. And you pull up his CV, and it's listed, oh, he was a follower of National Socialism. Follower. That's the lowest grade that you... I mean, it's still there. I mean, it's sort of part of the history. It's out there. It's not hard to really do a lot of research. It's fairly easy. If you know evidence, and you know they're German, you can look them up, and you'll see what they would, you know, what you do during the war. That I was shocked. In fact, I think I told Warren when I went on the Leipzig site to see that they have someone named Hermann Voss, V-O-S-S there as well, professor. Voss was foreign, but he's listed, and he's listed as a follower of National Socialism, which is not, you know, very, very low level thing. You have to understand, I mean, a lot of them were denazified very quickly, because if you have to understand, once we took Germany, once Germany collapses, it's being occupied, the Brits and the French couldn't feed themselves. They had an occupying zone, but they couldn't take care of anybody. They couldn't feed French and Brit. We had to feed everybody. Our guys wanted to go home. We didn't want to spend our time taking care of them. America had to do that. They had to let them take care of themselves. Fine. We're Nazi doctor. Go take care of Germans. We're going home. So there was this whole, I mean, it's a very complex sort of issue that... But it's there. It's sitting right out there. Go to Leipzig and every all of them, right? Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Dr. Lefrak, and for very moving and frightening insight into the topic. Thank you for coming.